Oh, come on. Okay, sorry, the computer has been completely shut down, so it took forever to bring it up. Questions? So I have been busy writing a proposal, and I'm not even sure where I am. And I'm sure several of you don't know where you are, because I think some people aren't even here, because the project 2 is due. So this is going to be one of the extremely lucid classes. So I don't know what I'm talking about, and you don't know what you're listening to, but we'll see how it goes. So the project 2 is due. You're going to be submitting it before you leave. The last part of the project, with project part C, will be assigned essentially I think next week, and it will be due a little before the end of the semester, so that you will have the ability to, I mean, the part of the deal is that you will have to show the demo of your working code to the TA. And so there would be a due date by which everything should be working, and then there will be a demo sign-up sheet, and you show the stuff working. And for all the three parts, basically, since it's building up on part A, part B, and part C. Okay, so that's the way it's going to be. And then part C normally has, apart from some required things, you can also have some choices as to what you want to embellish your search engine with. Okay, certain obvious things are things like adding clustering, you know, to the search results and so on. Okay, so that's where it's going to go. So a couple of people, I must have been asleep when I was writing this. Okay. A couple of people have sent me mails, sent TA the mails actually, asking for extensions. And basically, I don't think that it makes sense to just make a case-by-case extensions. So what I am going to suggest is that for that, and from now, and including this project, I'm assuming that everybody is done, but those of you who had, you know, trouble, I think they're going to be, I think I'll give everybody, without questions asked, 2 or 3 days extension, extension days that you can use any which way you want, and then there will be a penalty for those. And so you can always just say, I'm using that, and I write down that date, and then, you know, you will take, I think, about 3% penalty per day that's used. That would help you for the rest of the semester. So you don't have to ask these specialized questions one-on-one. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. I mean, as it is, I think my bigger issue is to make sure that it's just the same standard for everybody, rather than, you know, giving exceptions to the people who ask and sort of, in essence, penalizing people who play by the rules. Okay, that just makes no sense. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
We discussed clustering in an abstract way, and it's not clear for me, for example, when this will give good results in practice, because this grouping of dots, which we discussed, doesn't tell anything having sense. And are there classical or
there are lots of applications of clustering, whether or not the clusters that are found are related to, so in fact, if I can get this, I mean, I don't know, it's not very clear what would be the way to convince somebody that unsupervised learning could make sense, right? Because it could sometimes work, sometimes not work, based on, as I said, there's so many variations, such as the way you define the distance. But there was something that I was going to show last time, but I didn't show, but maybe that would help for those of you who have never seen clustering before. So this basically is an idea called vector quantization, and that's sort of routinely used in image compression. Okay, so the idea in image compression is that you have a picture like this, and you know there are multiple pixels, and each pixel has its own intensity level, and you normally are supposed to remember all of them. Okay, the big deal, of course, is to try and reduce the amount of data you remember. Okay. Learning is generally connected to compression. You know, there are some obvious connections. And in particular, one idea is, suppose I want to remember only, basically, rather than remember all possible intensity values, I want to only remember a certain number of them. Okay? So what I could do is, for example, the number of values I remember would become the number of the number k in the k-means algorithm, okay? And then you run k-means on these intensity values, setting the k to that value, and then for any point in that cluster, just remember the centroid value, not all the values. And that's what happens to this picture if you have a certain value of k, and a large, you know, a smaller value of k in this case. In this case, basically, you're reducing the number of clusters. Okay. Now, does this convince you of anything? I'm not quite sure, right? And the other example of clustering was the clustering of the results, the search results, and that seemed to work sometimes. Okay. Again, the point is ultimately whether or not the distance measure that you're using has any real connection to the domain description. Okay. And that's a big issue. And you know, if you have described, so in this particular case, everything is being talked about in terms of basically real valued numbers, which are all intensities. Okay. In the case of text documents, you are thinking that the right way to represent them is in terms of the words appearing in them, and then the distances between them should be described in terms of vector similarity. To the extent that's a reasonable idea, the clusters you find would actually make sense.
Yes, at least now I can
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's like, it's called unsupervised learning, but it's unsupervised in the sense that you're never saying who is in what cluster. You know, there is no known clustering, that's the gold standard, okay? But if you do have a distance measure, you can then use that to decide what would be internally consistent clustering, okay? That may or may not correspond to the external actual clusters that are there. Okay, but then this is a very, you know, unsupervised learning as a whole is a tricky situation. I mean, the philosophers and psychologists have wondered, are there categories in the world, or do we just see them as categories? And you know, somebody else would cluster them into different ways. So for example, are there categories called Russians and Chinese and Indians? Are they just totally nonsensical categories? And they're much more interesting categories that somebody would do if they came from Mars or some more super intelligent, you know, place and clustered us. We'll never know, okay? And the reason we defined Russian and Chinese as clusters is because we have decided a reasonable feature for people is nationality, etc. If you remove nationality as one of the features describing a person, may or may not be the case that, you know, clustering based on Russian would make sense. Maybe clustering based on Russian would make sense. Clustering based on American does not make sense, right? Because it's, you know, all immigrant countries are melting pots. It becomes very hard. Okay. I don't know whether that's both the clustering and the classification bring us into essentially large areas. I mean, as I said, in this whole class, everything opens up a new area of which we are just looking at that whole area only from the point of view of how is it going to be useful for information retrieval. But then they existed even before information retrieval and, you know, web came along. Okay. So we looked at clustering first, which is unsupervised learning, and now we are actually going to be looking at classification learning. Now, clustering and classification learning as a whole together is seen as essentially part of machine learning and statistical pattern recognition, and you can take series of courses on that. Okay. So clearly I'm not making any claims that of exhaustion here, that, you know, we have exhaustiveness here in the sense that I'm going to teach you everything about all the possible learning techniques. But we have to understand classification, and we have to understand some reasonable techniques that seem to be very applicable for text classification, because that's the kind of thing that we are interested in doing. Okay. So in the classification learning is given a set of labeled examples of a concept, which we call training examples, learn to predict the class label of the unseen examples that are given to you as test examples later. Okay. Now this is an easier problem to some extent than clustering, because it's not even clear that there are clusters to be found. You just are given data and you are looking for clusters. Nobody even told you that there are clusters. Nobody even told you that there are categories in the world. Whereas in the classification learning, I do at least say that here are some examples. These are the good ones, these are the bad ones. Now here's a new test case. Can you tell me this is a good one or bad one? Okay, it's still underspecified, significantly underspecified, because you don't quite know what is my function which applies to the example, you know, which when applied to the example gives yes or no. And you're trying to learn the function, essentially. Okay, so it's an underspecified problem, and so you make it, you increase the specification by having something called biases that we'll talk about in a minute. But you can see that it is different from clustering, because at least here you know that there is a good answer, there is a bad answer, at least on the training example. Okay, now on the test examples, of course, there may be an oracle we will know, but the system itself, when it's given the test example, it just has to basically classify without, based on what it's learned on the training example. Okay, and then of course its performance will be evaluated based on how well it does on the test cases. Okay. So there are all sorts of examples of classification learning. You know, the patterns that you might be trying to find would be, is this a picture which has human faces or not? Okay. Is this a text document that is about financial meltdown? Is this an email that is spam? Is this a credit card transaction that's fraudulent? Okay. In all these cases, you give some examples where you know that the credit card transaction is fraudulent, or you know that this is a spam mail, and you're supposed to learn the function from those training examples, and you're trying to use that function to classify the test examples. Okay, so that's basically, and then so from the text classification point of view, here are some examples. So the most important issue is, in fact, I can actually say that the whole information retrieval enterprise is really classification learning. Okay, what you are doing is, given a query and a user, is a document relevant or not? Okay, and based on a bunch of queries and for a bunch of users for whom we know what have been in the past relevant documents, you're trying to learn whether this particular document is going to be relevant. Okay, and then, you know, the spam mail is another case in scenario, another text document. Mails are text documents to a large extent, and then you're trying to figure out whether or not this mail is supposed to be spam or not. And you do realize that these classification learners can be wrong, and when they are wrong, you lose mails. You know, if they say something is spam when it is not, then it's your mom sending you a mail, you lose it. You know, ASU actually has recently put in a very strong spam protection thing which kills both spam and non-spam mails, and I'm losing a bunch of mails. So some of us probably got Turing Awards and Nobel Prizes, and it just got spammed. You know, we don't know. It's just been removed. And so, in fact, there is some place, you know, in case you are wondering whether you are losing mails, there is a place where you can go to see what sites as a whole ASU decided to blacklist. I'm just hoping that the sites in Sweden have not been blacklisted. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that people are trying to do to, you know, combat the spam. And so a more fine-grained approach would be, as the mail reaches your mailbox, before putting it into mailbox versus spam box, you try to, you know, compute whether it's a spam or not. And similarly, is this article relevant or not? Given an article, can you tell which news group it is from? In fact, this is interesting. This in itself is becoming an anachronism. You know, how many people even know news groups, Usenet news groups? You know, that used to be like a big deal for a while, but, you know, now there are no news groups that people keep track of. But, you know, if you have, you know, news groups or even magazines. So, for example, there are right-leaning versus left-leaning newspapers and magazines, and I give you an article, can you guess who wrote it? Is this a right-leaning newspaper or a left-leaning newspaper, just from the article? Okay? And then one other classification idea that we looked at earlier is this page likely to lead me to pages relevant to my topic? That is very useful in topic-specific crawling. Because after you bring the page in saying it's useful or useless is very different from even before you go forward on the page. Can you actually predict whether the links from this page are likely to lead to good pages or not? Okay. And then there's one more thing which we'll look at soon enough in recommender systems, where basically because you bought certain items, then would this new item be of interest to you? How does Amazon, for example, show you that you may be interested in the following book? It turns out they do two different things. One is people who have bought the books that you have bought also have bought this new book, so maybe you are interested in this. Okay, but a different version that they do is, you seem to be a politics geek. You bought all this, you know, liberal or conservative books, and here's a new one, and you would be interested in it. Okay, the second one is called content-based filtering, where you are essentially looking at the content of the purchases that they have made to decide whether a new item would be relevant. The first one is called collaborative filtering, where without even knowing what is inside the item, you're saying you should be interested in this because other people who seem to be buying the same stuff as you are interested in this. We'll talk about content-based and collaborative filtering in a while, right, like next class or something. But content-based filtering is really categorization and classification. Okay? So there are all these examples, all these scenarios where classification is very useful. And in particular, text classification is very useful for us because, you know, that's like the examples are described in terms of text features, words and phrases and so on. Okay. So having said that, let me just talk about a completely different looking example which has no words right now. And this is, at least for those people who have done Intro to AI, they have seen this example. This is basically a classification learning example, a really silly scenario where what we are trying to find is, here are a bunch of restaurant scenarios where the patron, in this particular case, Russell, Stuart Russell, who is the textbook writer for Intro to AI, he would decide whether or not to wait to be seated in a restaurant. Okay. And we are trying to guess, given a particular restaurant scenario, whether or not Russell would actually wait to be seated or would he just abandon and leave. Okay, and then the way you are defining each of these scenarios, obviously, is in terms of some features. Now, the biggest issue, of course, is going to be which features do you use to describe the scenario in which, each of the restaurant scenarios. So the features that I've used here is whether there is an alternative for the restaurant. Okay, if this is the only restaurant in town, where are you going to go? Okay, is there a bar? Is it a Friday? Are you hungry? Are there any patrons there? How pricey is the restaurant? Is it raining outside? Do you have reservations? what type of cuisine is there, and approximately what is the estimated wait time. These are the features I have used. What's more interesting is universe minus this is the rest of the feature. For example, how many buses were on the road at the time he went to the restaurant? What's the color of Russell's shirt? What's the color of the 15th pattern in the restaurant's shirt? Okay, how many hairs does Russell have? Okay, now you may laugh at this, but the point is, how do you know that they are not relevant? You don't know what you're trying to classify, right? So the question is, in some sense, in even making the example scenario, the problem of people tend to pick the features that are actually relevant to classify the example. So they're making your life simple. Okay, now unfortunately, if you think of like an email message, what part of the email message is going to be, what part of the email message is going to be deciding whether it's spam mail or not? You don't quite know. Okay, nobody tells us. So you are more or less given the entire set of words, the entire list of words in the email message. And you're trying to figure out. And maybe not all words are as important in deciding whether the message is spam or not. Okay, so there nobody actually selected features. You're given all the features, at least in that particular scenario. Here somebody very carefully selected some of these features. Even these may be, some of them may be relevant, some of them may be irrelevant. But one of the big problems that, you know, gets solved even before learners start doing learning is this, whether how many features, have what features have you used to define your example. Okay, equivalent in the clustering case is what distance measure are you using. Somebody else has decided, and based on the distance measure, your clusters change completely. Okay, so assuming that these are the features, and then in this particular training examples, you know, here, you know, the Russell waited, here Russell did not wait, and so on. So the question, of course, is, given a new example defined in terms of these features, can you guess whether, you know, he would wait? Okay, that's the idea. Now this is similar to book preferences, predicting credit card fraud, predicting when people are likely to respond to junk mail, which is a more interesting scenario. In fact, you're talking about spam mail, and you are only thinking about how to stop spam mail. The people who are sending spam mail instead, on the other hand, are trying to figure out who are likely to actually open and read spam mail. Because it's much more useful to send spam mails to them than to the rest of the people. Do you understand? You know, especially if you don't have a spam checker, when in the old days there would be junk mail coming in the postal mail, but it still comes now. So how many of you are likely to even open a junk mail saying you may already have $1 million? And if they can guess with some accuracy that a certain type of population tends to open them, they're much better off sending more of these letters to them. Okay, that's a learning strategy too. It's an adversarial scenario where they are trying to classify you into the guy who is a sucker or not, and you're trying to classify them as the guy who is trying to, you know, throw me a spam mail or not. Okay, and all of them are classification learners. And in fact, one of the interesting things that, since I just said that, since both these learnings happen at the same time, there is, even though we'll be talking about standard classification learning tasks, really what you have on the web is an adversarial classification learning task. Okay, if I know that people use certain features to decide what mails are spam and what are not spam, then I'm just as intelligent as them. So I'm going to make sure that those features are not present in my emails. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I mean, if you put capital letters Viagra in your mail, you know that most even dumb people have figured out how to not read those mails. So don't do that. Okay? In fact, in the past, one of the very simple ideas that people used to have to do spam checking is to compute some reasonable signature of the email, just like a 64-bit signature of the email, you know, checksum sort of a thing. And then what happens is, if a whole bunch of people are reading mail, such as in Gmail scenario, where lots and lots of people have accounts in Gmail, And if one guy says, yeah, this is a useless mail, and spams it, and you know, like 10 of them do it, then the rest of the people, you know, that Gmail itself can just remove that mail, saying enough people have removed this. Okay, now the question, of course, is how does it decide that other people are getting the same mail? You know, one idea would be to compute the signature. That looks like a silly, simple idea. But then as soon as it became obvious that that's what, you know, spam checking software was doing, people started putting random number of extra characters in each instance of the same spam mail, so that the number, signature is not the same. Okay, so that's also a more interesting scenario. So how do you make learning algorithms which are essentially sensitive to the adversary? Okay, but we won't even get into that. Okay, so now even if you take something like this example, right, you're trying to figure out that there is some function on these features that hopefully would say yes or no. And you're trying to compute the structure of that function just from these examples. It's a hugely underdefined problem. Okay, and so what happens is that every learner out there decides that the function has a certain form. Now, there is no real reason why the learner decides that. It's because if I know how to learn linear functions, I just hope that the world is made up of linear functions. If I know how to learn quadratic functions, I'll hope that the world is made up of quadratic functions. If I know how to learn neural networks, I'll hope that the world is made up of neural networks. Okay, some of these function biases are general in the sense that any potential function could have been written in this form too. Okay, neural networks, for example, have the property that any continuous or discontinuous function so can be done with, you know, if you allow one hidden layer in the neural network, you can do any continuous function. And if you do two hidden layers, then you can even capture all discontinuous functions. Okay, so there is that. Okay, but normally there is this problem that there are other cases where you just assume, so for example, so that's the neural network as the bias. Here is another learner which is assuming that whatever you are trying to teach me can be written as a 20 questions function. Okay, so I'll check whether patterns there are none, some are full, and if so, if it's none, then I'm done. If it's some, then I'm done too. The answer is no here, yes here. If it is full, I have to ask some more questions. Okay, so that's the function bias, that decision. This is called a decision tree learner, and the function bias for the decision tree learner. This is a function bias for a neural network learner. Here is a function bias for what's called an association rule learner, which essentially thinks that everything is written as a bunch of if-then rules. Okay, basically the certainties associated with them called support and confidence. Okay, and then yet another one assumes that the function essentially is a Bayes network. So it's a sort of a probabilistic model which generated this data. Okay, and all I'm trying to do is, given the data, I'm inverting to compute the original model. Okay, Bayes networks and neural networks essentially are very general in the sense, if you allow any arbitrary depth neural network, it can capture all the functions. If you allow arbitrary depth Bayes networks too, you can capture all probabilistic models, more or less. I mean, there are some interesting issues, but in general, you can capture. Okay, now in the case of neural networks, it turns out that the easiest kind of neural networks that can be learned are what are called perceptrons, which are single-layer neural networks. In the case of Bayes networks, equivalently, the simplest class of networks that can be learned are single-layer Bayes networks, are what's called, so basically, just one layer. Okay, so, and those are called, that essentially corresponds to what's called naive Bayes classifiers. Naive Bayes classifiers. Okay, now here is one interesting thing. I mean, for those of you who haven't thought about classification in the past, the trick that you have to deal with is, so there is, you know, let's see, actually no, let's put it this way. Since it's classification learners, then so there are pluses and there are minuses. Pluses means those are the examples, minus means they are not examples in the training case. So what you're trying to learn in a classification learner is essentially the decision boundary, the boundary which separates the pluses from minuses. Okay, now obviously I could do a line boundary, and it looks like a pretty reasonable thing to do is to find this line here. Okay, then the assumption then is anything above that line is negative, anything below this line is positive. Now is this completely correct? No, it's not completely correct even for the training examples. But then whoever said that even the training examples are completely correct? Now the assumption is that teachers could be saying wrong things. So they may, the original training data might itself have been corrupted. Okay, in that case, in fact, you are better off learning this as the function than learning learning something like this. That would correctly predict all the training data. Okay, but you would say that this sort of may be overfitting, in the sense that what it is trying to do is actually increase its performance on the training data rather than on the test data. To the extent there is any noise in the original training data classification, overfitting to the training data is going to reduce your performance on the test data. Okay, now the interesting thing, of course, is if you are going to only look at single layer neural networks, okay, then you would never even be able to learn this. Because single layer neural networks, you know, those of you who have thought about it before, but you can just take it from me today, that all that a single layer neural network does is to find, is it tries to find a decision, a linear decision boundary between the negatives and positives. Okay, so in a way you could say that if in fact the right decision surface is sort of a quadratic boundary, then the single layer neural network would miss it. So that would be a bug. But the same bug is a feature in this case, where really the best idea would have been to go for the linear surface. And you know, a multi-layer neural network would more likely have overfit itself to the data. Okay, so there is this the idea, there is this idea, a stronger idea called bias variance trade-off, and that basically refers to this point that you can overfit to the data, you can overfit to the data and increase your correctness on the training data to 100%. But that does not necessarily increase your accuracy on the test data in general. Okay? And so, of course, so there are two points we made, which is every learning algorithm has a bias, inherent bias. The ones which have weak biases, such as multi-layer neural networks, a weak bias essentially means it can actually capture any function, which means it is likely to keep churning away. I mean, unless you're careful, you can make it churn away until it is correctly classifying all the positives and negatives in the training data. But that could be the wrong thing to do in many scenarios, especially when the original training examples might have noise. Okay? And then the high bias ones are those where the learner basically is physically incapable of learning anything more than a certain class of functions. Okay, so for example, single layer neural networks are naive-based classifiers. They're making these huge assumptions on the world that everything that's worth learning will be learnable using lines. Now, if you're looking for lines, you will find lines. right? If you're looking for lines, you'll find out. In fact, I remember there's this little funny article that I read where how psychologists manage to find lines even if the underlying data is a sine wave, right? So you basically say, you know, first you sample it, and then say half of the data is, you know, noise, and then the other half falls nicely on the line. Okay, so if you want to find lines, you will find lines. If you want to find circles, you will find circles. Okay, the real question is, what is it that the original function is supposed to do? This is not so different from what we were talking about in clusterings too. If k-means is let loose on the world, it will try to find spherical clusters. If the world actually has spherical clusters, and k-means is good at finding it, it's well and good. If the world doesn't have it in your case, then, you know, what it finds is basically finds circles anyway, you know, spherical clusters anyway. Okay? So bias limiting the, so high bias essentially means very, so weak bias means any type of function can be represented. Strong bias or high bias means only certain types of functions can be represented, or at least the underlying learning algorithm essentially makes strong assumptions about the function type. Okay. Now notice that even in the weak bias scenarios, even if you have a multi-layer neural network, it might first try to learn a single layer neural network, and if it's not happy with it, that means if the noise on the training data, if the error on the training data is too high, it may then go to the next level and so on. That's fine. That's a kind of a bias. It's basically a preference bias. It prefers lower, you know, complexity models. Okay, but you know, if you what you have is just a perceptron, then it doesn't even try higher depth neural networks because it doesn't know how to learn them. Okay, and that might actually be sometimes useful because you'll get done faster. All you're trying to do is finding lines. The learning complexity is lower, it turns out, than if you're actually trying to find all possible functions that would best fit the data. Okay, again, what I'm doing is giving you some sort of an overview of kind of more foundational issues in machine learning, which we would not have too much time to go into. You can take Intro to AI to get a more leisurely background on that. You can take a machine learning course or a statistical pattern recognition course to get even more, okay? But this is sufficient for us to go forward. Now, given any of the biases, essentially the learner winds up having to find certain parameters. Okay, so if you are talking about neural networks, the examples are used to learn the topology of the network and learn the edge weights. Okay, in the case of a single layer neural network, topology is fixed. Basically, there is like one node connected to all the examples, all the features of the examples. So all you need to find out is the weights. So topology issue goes away if it's a single layer network. In the case of learning the probabilistic models too, you would have to learn the topology of the network, and equivalent to weights, what you need is conditional probability tables. So in a Bayes network, for every node, you need the probability that that node takes a value given the parent takes a different value. That's a conditional probability table. So you need the conditional probability tables for the network. Okay. Now, for the simple case of single layer Bayes networks, which are basically naive Bayes classifiers, topology is a no-brainer because there is no topology. It's basically you're assuming that the class, which is Russell weights, is causing all the features to happen. We'll get to that in a minute again, but that's the assumption, okay? And so there is simple topology, and all you wind up doing is just find the conditional probability tables for each of these nodes. So for this particular case, what's the probability that it is Friday, given that Russell is actually, given that we know that Russell waited at this restaurant? What's the probability that it's Friday, given that we know that Russell did not wait at this restaurant? Those are the numbers you need here. Okay? And of course, you know, making single layer network means you made a big assumption that everything, the probabilistic underlying model is actually representable this way. It's only a certain type of probability distribution that can be represented like this. And we'll talk about it in a minute. But in particular, you can see now that everything has to be independent of each other, given that you know what Russell did. That's the fundamental point of Bayes networks. In a Bayes network, a node is independent of every other node, given its immediate parent. So immediate parents will just shield it. Okay? And in this particular case, given Russell, Friday is shielded from patrons and waited, wait time. So these all become independent. Okay? We'll see how this will become useful in actually doing the learning, but you're actually seeing here that the CPTs that you will compute would be very simple structure. Okay, it's basically saying, what's the probability that it's Friday, given that that's a wait? Okay. There are also, apart from these, you can also say that I would not learn a function at all. I will assume that the examples themselves represent the function. Why do I need to compress them into a function? Whatever is the training examples and their labels, I'll just leave that. This is my representation. Okay, that I didn't show that in the picture, but that's one example, one idea of doing learning, which is I'll just keep this as my representation. Now, if I have kept this as a representation, what do? If I get a new example whose label is not known, I can compare it to all these guys. If I know some notion of a distance, I don't know what's the right way to define distance, but if when in doubt, you can always throw in the Euclidean distance and hope that you're somehow lucky. Okay, and suppose you compute some reasonable distance metric between the new feature vector and existing feature vector. Okay, and then basically rank them, all the rank with all the other feature vectors in terms of their closeness to the new guy. Okay, and find the majority label of the top 10. So among the top 10 closest examples, if majority of them say positive, then this is positive. If not, it's negative. So what is it doing? It's basically, this is the geometric interpretation here. You are assuming that you're basically, instead of going to this extra step, I'm just leaving the examples themselves as points in this i-dimensional space. Okay? And given a new point, I'll compute its distance to all the examples. Okay, take the k closest examples and find which is their majority label. So majority of them are positive, then this becomes positive. If not, it becomes negative. Okay, this you can see will make sense quite a bit if in fact had it been the case that all pluses are here in a nice little cluster, a spherical cluster, and all minuses are here in a nice little spherical cluster, and the guy who you are looking for is here. Then you would say, you're close to a positive guy, so you must be a positive guy. Okay, so that basically is the nearest neighbor, that's called the nearest neighbor approach. And what we will do in today is, in terms of the text classification examples, we will look at two nearest neighbor examples, nearest neighbor techniques, that you actually, one of them you already done. But they obviously, you can do this, it's a no-brainer, because all you need is a reasonable distance measure. And you do have a distance measure, you have done the vector similarity, so you can apply that. Okay, I'll show you two slides to say formally I have defined it, but essentially you know where I'm going with it. Okay, and then we'll also look at naive-Bayes classifier, which is actually quite useful for text classification techniques. Okay, there are other things too, but of the elementary classification biases, NBC, naive-Bayes classifier, seems to be a great approach, which is fast to compute and also has reasonably good accuracy. Okay, now why that is the case is pointed out here. Two important things. Up to here, we are talking about any example, any classification learning scenario. Now we are actually interested in text classification learning. Now the interesting point about text classification learning is, unlike Russell example where there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 features, a normal text classifier has to deal with how many features? Vocabulary is the number of features. Right? Every word. In fact, the one of the weirdest things is if you have 10,000 males and one of those males has the word opossum in it. It's like a reasonably rare word, you know, at least, you know, kind of reasonably rare to get males to you which have the word opossum in it. Now suddenly it becomes part of your vocabulary. So it's a feature for every document. And it'll be zero for most of them and one for this guy. Okay? So what this means is essentially the text documents are points in very high dimensional spaces, which is not a surprise to you, but you have to realize that this is not a particularly good example to go with. This is like 10 words. 10 words not in the document, 10 words in the vocabulary. That's what this corresponds to. Okay? Now when you have high dimensional spaces, one of the biggest problem is that essentially you can overfit to the data extremely easily. Okay? You can always find a function, you know, if you have a reasonably weak bias, you can always find a function that correctly classifies all the positives and all the negatives in the training examples. But it most likely would have overfit to the data to the extent that it's not likely to do well on the other examples. Okay? And so what that means is that we would like to go for high bias algorithms. It's useful to have high bias algorithms. Another point about this is actually a related point here is that text categorization examples have many, many features. Unlike this scenario where I already made sure that the hair color of Russell and the shoe size of Russell and whether or not there are buses on the road on the restaurant were not listed as potential features. Right? Were not listed as potential features. In text categorization, you throw in every word that's in the main, that's in the document. So many, many of these are irrelevant features. Many, many of them are relevant features. Okay? To decide whether or not something is a spam mail, a huge number of words in the mail have nothing to do with whether or not it's going to be spam. Like is not going to decide whether something is going to be spam. The is not going to decide whether or not something is going to be spam. But neither is one instance of the word Viagra going to completely decide that it's going to be spam. Do you understand what I'm saying? So there are two interesting points going together. One is there are irrelevant features. You know that for sure. Okay, everybody knew this before, but you're hoping that the problem was given to you such that irrelevant features are mostly removed. You can still try to remove some more irrelevant features from here, but you know, feature selection problem becomes much more of an issue when you have high dimensional space. Which is again not surprising to you because we have done LSI, you know, latent semantic indexing, and that was again because there were too many relevant features and some of them are dependent on each other. And you know, so we had to take that into account in coming up with a better basis for describing the example. Yes? Yeah. Well, LSI is basically, I think we'll talk about in a minute, but I talked about LDA, which is, which can be linear discriminant analysis, is connected to classification, and it does things very similar to LSI. But we'll talk about in a minute probably again. We did mention this in the class, in fact. Okay, so one of the interesting things is that this part means you should probably focus on removing irrelevant variables. And the second part means that you shouldn't focus on finding a magic key. There is no silver bullet which says, oh, if this word is there, it's spam. Okay? Do you understand? Now, come back here. Something like decision tree. To the extent decision tree learners are good, they'll be very good if, you know, the 20 questions is a useless game if every time you have to ask all 20 questions. In fact, you know, instead of 20 questions, why not have a 2 million question? You know, that's not a fun algorithm, I mean, a fun game to play, because if you ask 2 million questions, then, you know, the learner is dead, basically. Okay? To the extent decision tree learner does well, it must be because it found certain critical features which completely decide whether or not the label would be positive or negative. And since I said multiple features all give small weights, decision tree learners are not as good. Okay? Whereas things that combine effects from multiple directions are much better. And so, for example, neural networks are good and naive-based classifiers are good because they don't look for silver bullets. Okay? So naive-based, k-nearest neighbor algorithm that I was mentioning, these are kind of better because they don't try to look for silver bullets, but they consider the effect of individual features on the label. Okay? So these things you keep in mind, and one of the first one means that we are eventually going to look at feature selection. Okay, not today's class, but next class. Okay, but this means also that we'll actually look at KNN and naive-based and not going to look at decision tree learners. You can learn a decision tree for any thing, but it's not likely to be useful. It's more likely than not going to overfit. Okay, so k-nearest neighbor for text. There's an algorithm that I just said what it was there. Okay, given a new point, you're trying to compute its vector similarity to all the points. Take the top k closest neighbors, okay, and then, you know, let's hope that k is a odd number, okay, and then look for the majority classification of the k. That's what k nearest neighbor does. And that's a reasonable idea. Okay, now the problem, of course, is that if the amount of data increases significantly, then what do? Then you have to remember the entire training example set this way. Whereas the promise, the seduction, the temptation of these kinds of ideas is that you find a very simple function representation and then you can forget the data. Okay? This is why, in fact, learning is also connected to compression. Because rather than remember this whole data, you remember a simple description, a generative model that should generate this data on demand. And so this is a much simpler description than this whole thing. Okay? So anyway, k-nearest neighbors has this problem that if the size of the data increases, then essentially you're going to, you know, first of all, it's going to become more inefficient. You're going to compute distances to a huge number of points. Okay, but it's a reasonably good algorithm for text classification. It's not as simple as it is. It's actually a reasonably good algorithm. Okay, if you want to reduce the amount of things that you want to do for k-nearest neighbors, you could do something not that hard. You know, compute clusters, do k-means, no, m-means, okay, and find m-clusters, and find the centroids of those clusters. And then look for and see whether the new guy is closest to which centroid. This way you can reduce the number of comparisons you make. There's an algorithm. Okay? An extreme case is to just make two clusters. Cluster one, all positive. Cluster two, all negative. And you're done with it. That's what his Rocchio relevance feedback technique was. So take all positives, add up their vectors and divide it by the number of positives, that will give you the centroid of the positive cluster. Take all negatives, divide it by the number of negatives, you know, that will give you the centroid of the negative cluster. And given a new example, you find which centroid it is closest to. Okay? That's basically Rocchio relevance feedback. So you can think of it as a k-nearest neighbor algorithm where rather than work on the individual examples, you are first clustering the examples into two clusters, one positive cluster, one negative cluster, and just comparing the to the centroids. This will always be just two comparisons. Now, is this going to be good? It's going to be good if, in fact, this was a nice circular spherical cluster here and a spherical cluster here. If it's going to be really bad if the clusters or like this. And then the negatives were like this. Okay, now you might say, why did you make that? Well, I didn't make it. You know, you decided, I have my example. You decided to describe these examples in these silly features. Think about the following thing, okay? I'm trying to guess whether or not a student is going to pass this course. right? And you tell me, okay, here is the x and y axis. X axis is the hair color. Okay? And the y axis is the length of the index finger. All of you are points in the space. And I know which of you are going to pass, which are going to fail. I mean, I don't quite know, but you know, I can make it happen. You know? So the question is, if I were to plot you in this space, do you think there'll be a regularity? Do you understand what I'm saying? So, you know, anything is possible because you start with some reasonable features that you think are reasonable, but the actual classification was probably not made on these features at all. So if you project it into this space, it might look really silly. But then you do Rocker classification on this, you're in trouble because the centroid for the pluses is somewhere here, the centroid for the minus is somewhere here. And it's completely useless in deciding which is the right label. Right? Yes, sir. Yeah. If you know, yes, very much so. In fact, finding the right features is very important. Okay, but who even told you? For example, here is my thing. Okay, take this example, and if you're ever too drunk with the power of machine learning, think about this example. Okay, so here are the only features I use to describe you guys. Is there some way of doing LSI on this, such that you will get relevance out of this? You know, for example, can I say that cube of the index finger size plus logarithm of the hair color intensity would be a useful feature? Unfortunately not. Okay, so if I screwed up in defining the data, then I'm sunk. And would I know whether or not I defined the data correctly? No. Well, in cases like text data, yes, because pretty much you think every word in the mail is the only thing that people are looking at. Okay? Whereas, if you're talking about something like, you know, biological situations, right? You know, you don't even know what are the right properties to be looking at for the genes. So the ones that you know, you write them down, and so you get a nice little subspace. Okay? No amount of transformation of this subspace might still get you to the right subspace. Okay? That's just the way it is. Whereas, had this been all the words in the document, then you can do LSI, because some combination, and our LSI are nonlinear LSI, which is basically if there are true features which can differentiate positives from negatives, they must be connected to some complex combination of this lower level words, because everything ultimately is built up from the words. Okay, for example, you know, if you only wrote about words, right, so think about the following thing. You're trying to understand people saying something. The words is not enough. Prosody matters. Like it's going to happen. Okay, does that mean that it is going to happen? Does it mean that I don't at all believe that it's going to happen? You have to now not only write the word, but the intonation. That's part of the feature space. Otherwise, you're sunk. Okay? For males, you know that the only thing that people see is the words and maybe the italicization and the color. So as long as you described all of them, all you can have is too many features and too many probably useless features. And then you can consider doing LSIs or, you know, nonlinear feature selection and so on and so forth. Okay. So naive-Bayes classification. We'll start with that at least. Okay. So here is the problem. These are simpler to understand because here you didn't do anything to the training examples. You just used training examples almost as, in the first one, you left the training examples as the vectors. And the second one, the training examples were, you know, converted into centroids. Basically, each of them is a cluster and you got the centroid. Okay. Now in NBC, in essence, you're going to start thinking in terms of features. The features for text documents would be words. We'll talk about text documents a little later. First, let's just think in general terms about something like the Russell example, okay, which has a finite number of features. a small number of features. And so given an example E, you want to classify this example into one of the classes C1 to CN. That's what you're trying to do. And you've been given a bunch of training examples and their labels already. And given a new example, you need to do this. Now, each example has been described in terms of K features, okay, A1 to AK. And they can be, you know, multi-valued, they can be Boolean, they can be real-valued. We'll assume they are just multi-valued for now, okay? And so each AI can take at most D different values, okay? So what Bayes classification is doing is assign E to the class CI that maximizes this probability. If you know this probability, if you know the probability that given this example E, the probability that it belongs to what you have is class CI. If you know this probability for each of the classes, pick the class which has the highest probability. That's what Bayes would say. That's what probability theory would say. Okay? All you need is this number. The problem is you need to get this number. Nobody gives you this number. You need to get this number from the training example. You have to assess this probability. It turns out that assessing this probability is hard. What your training examples tell you is here is an example corresponding to class C12. And you know what its feature values look like. Training examples don't tell you, make up a random example, I'll tell you whether it is positive or negative. They'll come saying this is the label of the example. So you don't actually have these numbers. What would be easier is if you could write the other numbers, if you could get by with the other numbers, which is what's the probability of, given that this example is in class CI, what's the probability that it'll have this description E? It's the opposite question. Okay, now if you need this number from this number, you can use Bayes' rule. Okay, if you want to get P A given B, using P B given A, you use Bayes' rule. Right? Okay, and Bayes' rule basically says in this case that probability of CI given E is nothing but probability of E given CI times probability of CI by probability of E. Okay, and then somehow you compute this for each of the classes and pick the one that has the highest value. Notice that for every one of the classes, E is the same, so P of E is going to be the same number for every one of them. We don't know what it is, but it's going to be the same for all of them. So since all you care about is which is the one with the highest probability, you don't really need this number at all. All you then need is this, which is prior probability that a random example at all can belong to class CI. Okay, if there are like 10 possible types of examples, and you know, it's not necessary that all examples are of equal probability. Maybe the first two are close to 40% each probability, and the other eight together are the remaining 20%. So you need to know that prior probability, okay? And that you can assess, because if you have training examples, and if you see in your training examples, you have 100 of them, and only 8 of them have class C1, then 8 over 100 is an estimate of the prior probability of class C1. Okay, then this one is asking the conditional probability. Okay, given that you have class CI for this example, what's the probability that its description would be E? Now, this is easy to estimate. This you don't have to estimate. So I'm all stuck with just this. Okay, up until here I haven't made any assumptions, really speaking. Nothing. No assumptions. It's completely correct analysis, because it is right to assign the label as the class which has the highest probability given the evidence. And Bayes' rule is not an approximation. It's just a rule. It's just, you know, the idea of Bayes' rule is basically, it's just a little algebra. I mean, those of you who have forgotten, P of A given B is P of A and B by P of B. P of B given A is P of A and B by P of A. This is common, both of these things. So if you write P of A given B, P of A and B, that's P of A given B times P of B, and it's also equal to P of B given A times P of A. And Reverend Bass has become so darn popular because he said, well, I could write this P of P given A as P of A given B times P of B by P of A. That little algebra makes all the difference, because certain probabilities are easier to assess, certain probabilities are harder to assess. And getting by with the easier to assess probabilities is the trick. But till now, I haven't done any approximation. That's a law. That's an obvious law. That's the way the conditional probabilities are defined. Okay? So now comes the fun part. The question is, how are you going to estimate this probability P of E given CI? Okay? Now, it's hard. So really what I need to do is, since E is nothing but it's the conjunction of its features. That's the way example is defined. There's nothing more to the example other than its feature. Notice what I'm saying here. That basically means that you are nothing but the conjunction of your index feature length, index finger length, and your hair color. Okay? If I started with the wrong feature, so be it. That means, you know, I'm assuming that the feature space has everything to talk about the exam. Okay? So all I am computing here is probability of A equal to A1 is V1, A2 is V2, etc., AK is VK given CI. Okay? Now the problem in doing this is the number of such probabilities that you have to assess is very large. Think of just Boolean features. Think of just Boolean features. So K Boolean features and M classes. How many such probabilities do I need to assess? M times 2 power k. M times 2 power k. Learning, hardness of learning is normally talked about in terms of what's called sample complexity. How many samples do you need before you can learn? If you need to assess M times 2 power k numbers, well, okay, with M to be, let's say, you know, about 5 classes, and k is 100, and then I give you 3 training examples, do you have any hope? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so you need to do something such that you are not stuck with assessing these many probabilities. Okay, and normally when we compare learners, you will compare learners in terms of their sample complexity needed to reach the same level of performance. That's a reasonable thing. Some people require that they take introductory calculus class 5 times before they master it. And some require 1 time to master it. Some require hundreds and hundreds of times and they'll still not master it. Some don't even need to come to the class. They already mastered it. And the way we differentiate it is, you know, in terms of the complexity, the number of times you have to see the training examples before you get there. Okay. So this is the problem that we are stuck with, because this one will require too many examples. What can I do to get by with fewer examples? I will start hoping that the world is nice. When in doubt, just hope that the world is nice to you. Okay? So I'll just say, well, you know, probability of A and B and C and D can be written as probability of A times probability of B times probability of C times probability of D. If you can, that reduces the number of combinations you have to do. So if I can take this joint probability, and if I could write this as just multiplication of the individual probabilities, product of individual probabilities, then all of a sudden I have much fewer numbers to compute. Exponentially fewer numbers to compute. Has the world changed? No. I closed my eyes. Okay? And if just because you close your eyes, you don't necessarily get hit by bus. Right now, I'm closing my eyes. Nobody is hitting me. If I do it on the rural road, I will get hit by bus. Okay? So the issue is, you made a huge assumption here. To the extent the world actually is nice, that most learning examples you ever actually encounter, the features are reasonably independent of each other, not just completely independent. Notice what I'm saying. I'm not saying A1 equal to V1 is independent of A2 equal to V2. I'm saying A1 is equal to V1 is independent of A2 equal to V2, given class label to be C1. are given class label. Knowing the class label, you know more about A2's value if you also know A1's value. So that is extra information, it's redundant information. That's what I'm saying. Okay? And that in the Bayes network terms basically says the network that you have is class label causes each of the features. That's what Bayes networks say in this particular case. So if this is the case, then you know that FK would be independent of all other features given C. So in essence, in doing this little assumption, you know, before this assumption, you are essentially saying, I have a bias, but it's a weak bias. All I'm saying is, I'm going to learn the generative probabilistic model for the data. There's nothing wrong with that. That's as good as saying, I'm going to learn the neural network, multi-layer neural network for that. Okay? When you made this assumption, you then said, not all generative probabilistic models, but only the probabilistic models that can be written in a single layer with the class causing all the features. In particular, then, it means that there better not be any additional interactions between the features over and above those that are caused by just the class. Okay? So, this is fine, but if the real world is more like this, you're sunk. Then you're just finding an approximation to the real world. Okay? Now the nice thing is, we will stop here, but the nice thing is this assumption is bogus, but it seems to work, and it needs only n times d times k probabilities to be assessed, as again as n times k power d, d power k, n times d power k probabilities, where d is the number of values each feature can take. If it's 2, it's a Boolean feature, it's n times 2 power k for the general case. And if it is a multi-valued feature, it's n times d power k. Instead, you're getting by with n times d times k. Okay? Whereas the last time you made a huge assumption about the world and still got by fine. What? Bag of words, yeah, that's true. But even within the bag of words, even before you got there, you said a document is defined in the high-dimensional space represented by all its words, and all words are independent. You made a huge independence assumption. In fact, what you meant then was that knowing the value of one of the axes, this is my classic example I told you, if I have a 10,000 dimensional point, and I ask, I'm thinking of a 10,000 dimensional point, and it can take values, each coordinate can take values between 1 to 10. Can you guess it? You say, I can't guess it. Well, I mean, unless you're crazy. Okay, you'd say, no, I won't get it, okay? But then I'll make your life easy. I'll give you 9,999 of the coordinates of my 10,000 dimensional point. Now can you guess the last one dimension? You're just as clueless as before. You still can't get it. That's what it means for dimensions to be independent. If on the other hand, dimensions are linearly dependent or non-linearly dependent, knowing some of the dimensions allows you to guess the other dimensions. You got by with the independence assumptions until now, why don't I want to make one more? Okay? And in particular, one of the interesting things that happens is, A, it's known that naive-Bayes classification works quite well compared to the huge assumption it's making. And B, if you were to actually compute this probability, and if the number, the probability number matters, and if you compute it using this kind of a formula after this assumption, those numbers will be totally nonsensical. They'll be very far away from the real numbers. But all you care about is not the numbers themselves, but which of them is bigger. Okay, if the real probability for class 1 is 0.6 and class 2 is 0.4, the estimated probability for class 1 is 0.9, class 2 is 0.1, you still do the same thing. And it's a very interesting point that naive-Bayes classifier works larger, more times than you expect it to, because really you don't care about the assessment accuracy of the probabilities, but you only care about the relative order of the probability. Okay? So in the next class, we'll go through some of the obvious steps in computing these probabilities and look at some variations.